Meeting is now being recorded.
Good afternoon, everyone. It looks like it's about 1 o'clock, so let's get started with the webinar. I'm Christine Sandy, and I'm the Program Director of the Rural Assistance Center. I'd like to welcome you to our webinar today, an update from the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services. The committee has recently issued several reports or policy briefs on rural health system infrastructure, as well as proposals for reform that we'll be discussing today, including the implications of proposed changes to rural hospital payment designations, some options for rural health care system reform and redesign, and also rural implications of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. We hope to have time for your questions at the end of today's webinar. If you have questions for our presenters, please submit them towards the end of the webinar, and you can do that using the Q&A section of the screen directly beneath the slides. We will be muting your lines today, but we also ask that you mute your own lines at your phone, just to ensure that we don't have excess noise on the line. We have provided a copy of the presentation on the RAC webinar page, which is www.raconline.org/webinars. If you decide to go to that page during the webinar, just please don't close this webinar window or you'll have to log back in. And if you have any technical issues during today's webinar, please contact our support area using the phone number listed on the information screen. And if you're not seeing that screen, the number is 701-777-6305. Once again, for any technical issues, the number is 701-777-6305. Our first speaker today will be Ronnie Musgrove, who has served as the chair of the National Advisory Committee since 2010. He previously served as the governor of Mississippi from 2000 to 2004, serving as lieutenant governor prior to that. And Governor Musgrove is only able to be with us for a few minutes today, so we'll get right to his comments. Governor Musgrove?
Christine, thank you very much. I want to thank each of you for being on the call today and hope that it will be of some assistance to you as we look at these proposed policy changes. Christine later will introduce three of the members of the Rural Advisory Committee, and also Steve Hirsch will go through the background of the committee's function and what our role is with the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The reason the committee chose to issue briefs on the topics that Christine just mentioned is one, there are proposals to make some fundamental changes to Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement for rural health providers. The committee wanted to ask before changes are implemented to try to offer some guidance to the process. Cuts in payments or suddenly removing critical access status for some hospitals could produce severe reductions in availability of health care in rural areas. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation is able to experiment with innovations that are intended to both improve quality of care and control or reduce costs. The committee wants to be sure that it offers some rural-friendly demonstration programs and takes into consideration the special attributes practice in rural areas. And last, the committee does not believe that there is no need for reform, but wanted to offer some ideas and highlight demonstration programs that can guide changes to rural health care. You will be hearing from three of our really outstanding members of the advisory committee, and I believe you're in for a very good webinar and some exchanges of ideas from them. So, Christine, I want to say thank you to you personally and to the RAC for hosting the webinar.
Well, thanks so much for that introduction to today's webinar. And as you mentioned, during the remainder of today's call, we'll be hearing from the Executive Secretary of the committee, as well as three of the members, who will each speak about the committee's findings on a specific topic. So first we'll hear from Steve Hirsch, who is the Executive Secretary of the committee and provides that support to the committee from the Office of Rural Health Policy. Next we'll hear from Karen Madden, who is the Director of the Charles D. Cook Office of Rural Health for New York. In that capacity, Karen directs statewide rural policy development and implementation and also oversees programs totaling $18 million. She also serves as a staff member to the New York State Public Health and Health Planning Council. Karen will discuss the implications of proposed changes to rural hospital payment designations today. Then next, we will hear from Dr. John Cullen. And since 1994, Dr. Cullen has been a physician at the Valdez Medical Clinic, a four-physician private practice in a medically remote area, which is at the terminus of the Alaskan pipeline. He also serves as chief of staff at the Valdez Community Hospital and physician sponsor of the Valdez Emergency Medical Services. He's been a member of the Alaska Rural Medical Congress since 1998 and was named the Alaska Family Physician of the Year in 2008. And Dr. Cullen will tell us today about some options for rural health care system reform and redesign. And our final presenter will be Roger Wells. Since 1987, Mr. Wells has been a physician assistant at Howard County Medical Clinic in St. Paul, Nebraska. And in addition to his physician assistant degree, he also holds a master's degree in physical education and athletic training. And Mr. Wells will give us an overview of the rural implications of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, or CMMI. So with that, I'll turn it over to Steve.
Thank you, Christine. I'm Steve Hirsch. I'm located at the Office of Rural Health Policy in Rockville, Maryland. And at the end of the presentation, there's some contact information for people who want to know more about the committee. But I'll go through a brief description of what the committee is and what it does. The committee's one of the independent advisory boards that can offer advice to the Secretary of Health and Human Services and does so by meeting several times a year. It's an independent external voice made up of people outside the government who become members for a four-year term. The committee usually prepares either an annual report and or policy briefs or white papers and sends them to the secretary. In the past several years, we've been sending recommendations to the secretary on the ACA, the Affordable Health Care Act, and trying to make sure that the changes that are implemented due to the ACA are rural-friendly. The committee, the office itself and the committee was established back in 1987. In 2002, Secretary Thompson expanded the focus of the committee, which up until then had just been rural health, to include rural human services. And there are 21 members currently on the committee. And they're, like the members we have on this committee, they represent a broad geographical range from Maine to Alaska and include people with very strong backgrounds in rural health and human services. As you heard, former Governor Musgrove is the chairman. We have members from 16 states across the country. And in last year, in 2012, the committee held three meetings. The first was a winter meeting here in Washington, D.C. And as we followed that with two meetings, one in June, one in September, to allow the committee to hear directly from people out in the field. The two meetings that were held out in the field, one was in Kansas City, Missouri in June, the other was in Austin, Texas in September. And if you know anything about critical access hospitals, you'll realize, I believe, that well over 50%, probably close to 75% of critical access hospitals are within a day's drive of Kansas City, Missouri. And Texas is one of the a very large state that has a very large number of critical access hospitals as well. So we took the opportunity to go out and visit some of the critical access hospitals that were within driving distance of those two cities. Rural America, as I'm sure everybody on the call knows, has about 20% of the population of the U.S. in about easily 80% of the land area of the U.S., but it only has about 10% of the nation's physicians, and out of the over 3,000 health professional shortage areas in the U.S., the vast majority are rural and frontier areas. The rural health care market is it's very dependent on individual market. Small businesses are the key employers, and about one quarter of all rural adults are uninsured. There's a heavy dependence on the public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. Today's white paper topics are, the implications of proposed changes to rural hospital payment designations, the options for rural health care system reform and redesign, and finally, rural implications of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovations, which is part of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And I will turn it over to Karen Madden, who will present the first paper.
Thanks, Steve. As you all can see on this slide, this paper was called The Implications of Proposed Changes to Rural Hospital Payment Designations, and it was issued in December 2012. This paper was the result of the meetings that we had in Kansas City and Austin discussing the many and varied implications of changes to the rural hospital payments. Next slide, please. Just so everyone knows, I'm having technical difficulties here in New York, so I'm having to have the folks in North Carolina flip the slides for me. The two-part brief was a companion to the next policy brief, Options for Rural Healthcare System and Redesign. While this brief takes a shorter-term data-driven approach to examine several proposed changes to the payment system for rural hospitals, the second paper looks at the longer-term rural healthcare system as a whole. And the committee believes properly examining these proposals requires a short and long-term perspective. Next slide, please. The proposed changes to the rural hospital payment designations that we discussed were as follows. The Congressional Budget Office's mandatory spending option number 24 proposed eliminating Medicare payment designations for critical access hospitals, sole community hospitals, and Medicare-dependent hospitals. There exists among a broad range of possible options laid out by the CBO to reduce government spending, and the CBO recognized that outright elimination of these designations might decrease healthcare access in rural areas, even if it would save money. The administration proposed eliminating the low-volume add-on payment, reducing CAH reimbursement from 101% to 100% of allowable costs, and revoking the CAH designation for CAHs within 10 miles of another hospital. And that last part of that, revoking CAH designation for CAHs within 10 miles of other hospitals, has been proposed again by the administration. And MedPAC suggested that higher costs at CAHs may not be necessary, citing that 16% of CAHs are within 15 miles of each other. While MedPAC did not endorse revoking enhanced payment for CAHs within a certain driving distance from the nearest hospital, it did assert that Medicare should not pay higher rates to two competing low-volume providers in close proximity. Medicare appears to have assumed that nearby hospitals generally compete in overlapping service areas to attract inefficiently small patient volumes. Next slide. The administration outlined three proposals to revise the CAH payment system in its FY 2013 budget, and those were eliminating the low-volume add-on payment, reducing CAH reimbursement from 101% to 100% of allowable costs, and revoking the CAH designation for CAHs within 10 miles of another hospital. They estimated that these changes would save $6 billion over the next 10 years. MedPAC suggested that higher costs at CAHs may not be necessary, citing that 16% of CAHs are within 15 miles of each other. Next slide. The MedPAC June 2012 rural report suggested that higher costs at CAHs near other hospitals may not be necessary, again citing 16% are within 15 miles of another hospital, stated that Medicare should not pay higher rates to two competing low-volume providers in close proximity, but did not address the issue if nearby providers are necessarily competing, and concluded that Medicare payments to rural providers is currently adequate. So the committee, as many, probably all of you on this webinar, and many rural stakeholders throughout the country, was very concerned, naturally, about these various proposals to reduce costs, and did an analysis of these proposals based on data drawn by the North Carolina Rural Health Research and Policy Analysis Center. Part of that data included a spatial analysis that showed that revoking the CAH designation would have a large ripple effect across the rural healthcare system. But because of distance-based designation criteria, sole community hospitals would revert back to PPS if CAHs were forced to revert to PPS as well. And that's, I think, maybe one of those unintended consequences. The North Carolina data also indicated that critical access hospitals nearby other hospitals have a higher average daily census than more isolated critical access hospitals, which seems contrary to what you would just typically think of. So on the next slide, we have a chart that shows the number of hospitals affected by the changes or the proposed changes in distance criteria. And, you know, I certainly won't read through all the numbers because everyone can see that, but if you go down to hospitals that are less than 15 miles apart, you'll see that there's 245 that would be converted, but that number changes drastically when you look at the hospitals that are less than 10 miles, and it only impacts 55 hospitals. And 13 would be 13 Seal Community Hospitals, so the total would be 68 hospitals. Naturally, those numbers increase as the distance increases. And so next slide, please. Based on this data, the committee brought a few assumptions into the proposals in question. Critical access hospitals near or other hospitals did not appear to be competing for patients and often received higher patient volumes than the average. While critical access hospitals comprise 28% of all hospitals in the U.S., they only account for 2% of overall Medicare spending. And 19% of critical access hospitals are at a mid-high to high risk of experiencing financial distress in the next 2 years. These hospitals are dispersed across the country and are both near and far from other hospitals, so there's no connections that can be drawn. Next slide, please. This slide shows the average daily census distribution of critical access hospitals based on distance from the nearest hospital. One of the things, again, I won't read through all the numbers, but one of the things that I found most compelling is that if you look at hospitals that have an average daily census between 5 and less than 10, and those hospitals are between 10 and 20 miles apart, there's 222 hospitals in that range, which is quite significant. So I think those numbers speak for themselves. And next slide, please. So we concluded that the three proposed changes were too sweeping in nature and did not sufficiently consider the many nuances highlighted in our analysis. We also concluded that revisions to payment designations for rural providers should reflect a longer-term vision of the future of the rural healthcare infrastructure, and changes prompted primarily by fiscal measures may not best serve the needs of our communities or be sustainable over time. One more point is that the research center pointed out to us that over 70% of critical access hospitals' revenue comes from outpatient, which is consistent with the emphasis on emergency services and the legislation authorizing critical access hospitals. The committee, however, knows of little data that describe the roles of critical access hospitals in addressing emergency and outpatient needs, areas in which distance and transportation issues are more important than for inpatient services. There is no reason to assume that the distribution of inpatient indicators by distance directly corresponds to the need for geographically distributed outpatient services or emergency care. So I guess I'll hand this back to Steve.
Okay. Our next presenter will be Dr. John Cullen from Alaska, and he'll be talking about the options for rural health care reform and redesign.
Well, welcome, everybody. Yeah, this is John Cullen. And what I'm going to be talking about is some of the ACA implications for rural health care and then attitudes among health care providers regarding that. And we're going to be talking about the Frontier Extended Stay Clinics and the FCHIPS, which is a new designation. And I think the thing to remember is that there is a system in place that is working. That's the critical access hospital system. I just remember a very plaintive complaint by a physician in Texas that was wondering why is it that when something is working, the government always wants to get rid of it. In terms of the longer-term concerns of the committee, we do see that there is a conflict in terms of what's the long-term goal of healthcare reform, especially with regards to the Affordable Care Act. And there's some provisions within the Affordable Care Act that we think that critical access hospitals will actually do quite well with, especially with the value-based purchasing, as long as the parameters for that are applicable to small hospitals and small communities. But with that, we're concerned about the proposed changes with the critical access hospital payment currently that are out there. The big concern there is that it's going to take several years for the provisions for the Affordable Care Act to fully come into place that hospitals will be able to take advantage of. And if we change that critical access hospital designation, we may end up losing a fair number of critical access hospitals, which, you know, let's face it, that is a big part of the safety net within rural communities. There is a lack of awareness among rural providers about those provisions in with the Affordable Care Act, and then just other national trends as far as accountable care organizations and things of that sort. Part of that is that there's a shortage of healthcare providers in rural communities, and then the other part of that is that within administration, there's all the same jobs as of larger hospitals, but everybody ends up having to wear multiple hats. For example, I'm the chief of staff of our hospital. I'm also the head of EMS for our region. I'm off the head of the ER committee, the ICU committee, and the operating room committee. And so there's just a tendency for there not to be a lot of extra bench strength or of people to be looking at these provisions and what effects they're going to have on the rural communities. We are going to be looking at some new models and approaches for healthcare that take into those rural considerations into account. And part of that, one thing I wanted to mention as far as the rural communities in particular is that there's a huge problem with N, where N is the number. We see significant statistical variations within healthcare when you have small numbers, and that has lots of implications for designing healthcare systems. We talk in this committee about the average daily census, but unfortunately, it's not that there's that many people in the hospital at any one time. A lot of times, there's nobody, and then there's more than 10, and there's huge fluxes. This last week, actually, we had a gunshot wound to the chest in our emergency room. I haven't seen one of those in 18 years, and so there's a huge statistical variation. And yet, within these small communities, you have to be ready for major emergencies at the drop of a hat. And these may be things that you don't see on a real regular basis. And compounding that, of course, is the large distances involved in frontier and rural communities. One thing we found when we were talking at the site visits is that communities really do want a hospital. That seems to be one of the sort of status of success for a lot of those communities. And I think that it is really important when we're considering all this is that we are trying to maintain a minimum level of emergency response and emergency safety net. So observations from the site visits, there is a huge amount of variation in terms of health status and financial conditions, even between neighboring rural counties and even between individual communities within those counties. there's a saying that when you see one rural community, you see one rural community, and I think that's especially true within healthcare. And then compounding that is that there's interpenetration of various hospital systems and healthcare systems within those counties so that different communities may not even talk to each other because they're a part of different systems. The one thing that we did find that was continuous across all of the sites we visited was a very strong desire to take care of patients. And I think that is especially true in rural and frontier communities. You know, these are neighbors, friends, and family, and so there's a very strong desire to do whatever is necessary to take care of people. Rural communities are more vulnerable to boom and bust economies, and there's two parts to that. One is that a lot of times there's not a diversification of employers, and so if one employer leaves the community, that can have an absolutely devastating result. Likewise, there can be a strong seasonal variation. A lot of communities in Alaska, for example, our community in Valdez, doubles in the summertime because of fishing. And that's something that just makes it very difficult to plan for. And has some other implications as far as accountable care organizations and assigning patients and beneficiaries to those accountable care organizations. We did find a lack of awareness of the ACA provisions on the model. Nearly everybody we talked to would rather just stick with what they had. And again, that makes sense. Just given that the changes really have big implications as far as planning, and there's just not a lot of administrative excess capacity to come up with these changes. Everybody is pretty much working as hard as they can just with the current system to make sure that the patients are being cared for. On the other hand, we did see a fair amount of interest in exploring the potential of new models of care. But the one thing we did hear is that, you know, just tell us what to do and we'll do it, but then don't change it. Once you tell us what to do, we'll figure it out, because we always kind of work around the system. But let's not change it in the near future. So one of the things I'd like to talk about is the Frontier Extended Stay Clinics. And the next community over from Valdez has a Frontier Extended Stay Clinic, so I've been able to watch this from the inception. I've also talked with physicians and administrators at the other sites here in Alaska. So, because 4 out of the 5 Frontier Extended Stay Clinics actually are in Alaska, the 5th one is in Washington. And basically, what Frontier Extended Stay Clinics allow for is it allows for communities without a hospital to have an emergency room and the ability to have a 48-hour observation. And and what was happening in these communities is they were basically providing those services out of necessity. So the next town over in Glen Allen is 120 miles from us. It's 150 miles from the next community of 4,000 people, and about the same distance from Wasilla. And so, it's a very isolated community. There's moose and caribou on the road. It's icy. This is Alaska. And so they were taking care of major trauma. Anyway, it's basically out of a clinic situation. And so because of the cuts, they were able to actually expand their services. And it's done a lot to stabilize the medical care with that community. And talking with the providers, they see this as being a major improvement. The main reason, as far as cost savings for Medicare, is that if you have a Frontier Extended Stay Clinic, not only does it improve the emergency safety net, but it also reduces the number of transportations. And within rural and frontier communities, that's a major expense. Air ambulances can cost anywhere between $20,000 and $60,000 for transport. And so it's a any time that you can prevent that transportation, then that's going to save money. And a lot of patients really don't need a stay within a tertiary care hospital, especially with advances in telemedicine. They can be monitored quite adequately within a Frontier Extended Stay Clinic for at least that 24 to 48 hours before a decision is made about whether they truly need to be inpatient or whether they need to be transferred. And then this is going to hopefully would save costs. I think it's also important, too, that, again, and just in terms of maintaining that minimum safety net, and also in terms of disaster preparedness from a regional perspective. And if there is a regional disaster, then the Frontier Extended Stay Clinics can extend that emergency response. In terms of the 48-hour observation, one of the other things that happens in rural frontier communities, a lot of patients really don't want to be transferred to the big city. That's their family is in those communities. That's where their support is. And so that's a major disruption, not only for them, but for their entire family. And like I say, a lot of times that 48 hours is really all you need to determine whether or not further care is needed. Now, the downside of the Frontier Extended Stay Clinic is that, as opposed to a critical access hospital, is you don't have as much of a trained staff to handle emergencies. And I'm speaking specifically about the nurses and that and staff and physicians and mid levels that really respond to an emergency. And if you have a major trauma or multiple traumas, you'll need to have everybody possible. The other big issue is that they haven't they have yet to make up their upfront costs. The and I think that there's some problems with how that whole system was looked at. The one problem is that private insurance really doesn't know how to reimburse for services that are provided at a Frontier Extended Stay clinic. I was talking with one of the physicians in Dutch Harbor who had a major trauma there and ended up keeping the patient for a 24-hour period because of weather. They were unable to transfer the patient. And yet they were basically only able to charge at clinic level for services that were really quite extensive, which would have paid much greater if they had an emergency room designation. And I think, too, that when looking at it, that they when they were looking at the costs of or the benefits of FESC in the studies, that they really did not take into account the true cost of transportation, which is which for rural communities, I think, is one of the major costs. The other model that we're going to talk about is the Frontier Community Health Integration Project, which I'm really excited about. And basically what this is the formation of a Frontier ACO that utilizes the Critical Access Hospital as a base. One of the problems with providing services in rural and frontier communities with Critical Access Hospital is that setting up hospice, home health care, palliative care, has an adverse effect on the cost report. And so a lot of critical access hospitals are not offering the services, and yet they are the primary caregiver within these communities. And so without that, the services are just not being provided. And essentially what a FCHIP would allow for is integrating all those services within the community under one basically accountable care organization and using the pay-for-quality incentives. One of the other issues as far as hospice and palliative care and home health care is that a lot of times these need to be separate administrations, and there's just not the bench strength within a lot of these rural communities to allow for that. On the other hand, the accountable care organizations, which is a great idea, has some difficulties in rural areas because, for example, in Valdez, I think we have 400 Medicare beneficiaries. So if I were to set up an ACO, I would need to attract quite a number of other small communities if we were going to be an actual rural accountable care organization. Because you need about 15,000 beneficiary lives in order to have any kind of statistical significance in terms of quality. So as far as key recommendations, and actually one more thing about the FCHIPs is that I've tried to get the hospitals in Alaska to be interested, and there may be some issues relating to the way the FCHIPs were designed in that they have less utility, for example, in Alaska because we don't have counties per se. And I know that the hospitals in Alaska, the rural hospitals in Alaska see this as being limited utility at the moment. And yet I think it has great potential for really offering a greater variety of services within these rural communities. So in terms of key recommendations, we think that the Secretary should continue to promote the benefits of the Affordable Care Act and broaden health care reform. And that includes raising awareness among rural providers about the provisions and the models that we think that the accountable care, the Affordable Care Act will actually benefit these rural health care. And I think that in particular the value-based purchasing, the critical access hospitals may actually do quite well as long as the criteria are ones that critical access hospitals can achieve. But part of that is that we need to make sure that providers are a part of the discussion and realize that, for the most part, they are, many of them are overwhelmed and are working as hard as possible just to maintain the services that they have currently. And recognize that the current system is actually working fairly well. I mean, there are, I think we said earlier, 19 18% of critical access hospitals are having financial difficulty. But when this system went into place, it really did stabilize the hospital system within rural and frontier communities. We think that the Secretary should work with Congress to continue the Frontier Extended State Clinic demonstration, or at least continue it in some form. We don't think that the critical access hospital should necessarily be downgraded to Frontier Extended State Clinics, but rather that these could be used to bolster the emergency safety net within communities that don't have hospitals and may actually reduce costs overall, again, taking into account the cost of air transportation, which I think has not been looked at adequately. And finally, we think that we should really consider the full range of cost savings and when we're evaluating the Frontier Extended State Clinics and the FCHIPs in that, again, looking at the overall cost, not only of the air transportation, but what would have been the cost had they been admitted to a tertiary care hospital versus for the cost if they had stayed within the critical access hospital or the Frontier Extended State Clinics. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cullen. Next, I'll pass it over to our final speaker, Roger Wells. Roger?
Well, thank you very much. And my topic will be the rural implications for the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Service, or Medicaid Innovation. I certainly want to thank you for the opportunity to inform these interested participants about our work and our findings, and encourage you to look forward to initiation of new innovations, as it's probably one of the most opportune topics that we can discuss this afternoon due to the, quote, administrative authority, end quote, given to the Secretary. My discussion will cover the background of the program, the present status, and our future goals with this program. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Authorization is actually within CMS, and it's to test the innovations in the payment and the services model. Of course, it is to reduce expenditures and preserve or enhance the quality of care, but they're also to address a defined population for which there are deficits of care leading to poor clinical outcomes or potentially avoidable expenditures. To accomplish this goal, we must first define the population. Of course, in rural America, with 20% of the population in rural care, we have 30% of the dual eligibles, which are 15% of our Medicare and Medicare beneficiaries, and these are in the rural area, which is our highest cost to expenditures. The excellent population review. Also, the total cost of Medicare for the critical access hospitals is 2% of the budget. So in the double-edged sword, they're actually looking at us as a small token as how do you decrease the 2% budget to save money on a larger scale. Certainly the largest areas of expenditures were in the largest populations, directly proportional to the number of lawyers. But we still have the most challenging population with the most elderly and the most morbidity and the least amount of specialists. Therefore, the challenge is, much like the two previous speakers, to come up with innovations that will help us in the future and at the same time be neutral or lesser. The big issue with that then is to look at unique changes that we could look at with budget neutrality. And it only applies to a continuation or a formal option or adoption of projects. And so when I look at this, and as well as the committee, we look at it more in the focus of the rural population as being a continuum of care from the rural to the urban. And so the Innovation Center is able to modify Medicare and Medicaid programs without congressional processes, as we spoke earlier, and it only needs actuarial confirmation that it is needed with direct implementation available if we can prove these products are actually cost-effective. So it's very important to us to be in line with the research projects and to observe all the studies, even though they may or may not be rural implications, to the potential benefits and or deleterious effects that could occur. So there's no restriction to the depth of any investigation or to the width of the area of the study. What we need to do is watch very closely, which the committee has done with the initiation of these projects and are continuing to do. our promising early projects for the Center of Medicare and Medicaid innovation is that actually 26 awards, where some of them which were actually had a rural dimension. The federal qualified health centers had an advanced primary care practice demonstration. This indicates at least the start and recognition of the rural community and an initial partial medical home type model. It identified teams of care and management of patient outcomes were actually reimbursable. So what I'm really saying is the management aspect was a reimbursable aspect to the cost report, and it's actually an income for the participants. The advanced payment accountable care organization was open to the rural areas. However, because of the cap of $80 million and the definite limitations on available participants, critical access hospitals have a hard time being an accountable care organization, but in many communities are now joining with larger institutions in what we call that continuation of care. The Partnership for Patients is a transition program for the hospitals engaged in networks and communication as one part of it, and the other part was a community case-based care transition program, which really had nothing to do with critical access hospitals. But the errors in reporting and reduced costs certainly could be in documentation for future. The healthcare innovation challenge is for $1 billion. $1 billion is broken down to $1 to $3 million projects for innovation models in healthcare. And they do have real implication because as we go through these, we're eventually going to be indicated in some of these cost reflections. Because we transfer patients to these advanced centers and will eventually receive some of these patients back who will be in these models, and we may be ending up in some kind of a treatment program with them in the future. So with this tremendous opportunity, we have to be astute to what is happening in the rural communities as well as what's happening in the Center for Medicare and Medicare Innovation. So we recommended to the Secretary direct the CMMI to offer preliminary advice to the rural facilities. Just as Dr. John McCollins has demonstrated a little bit ago, we do not have the ability nor the technical abilities to write the grants and or innovation projects to the Innovation Center. And certainly with some kind of advanced knowledge or some technical assistance, it would be doing much better. The application process just for a grant would take a tremendously astute person a number of months. And number two, the Secretary direct the Center to extend the FQHC primary practice demonstration to rural health clinics. As we stated before, it gets a better understanding to the impact and the feasibility of the program, and it's also because of the investment costs for IT, administration, etc., qualified staff, it may be more restricted than we once thought, or it actually could be more beneficial in the final outcomes. Also recommended that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Interventions establish a group of rural advisors. And within the center, there are 200 advisors. These advisors represent finance specialists, insurance specialists, physicians, mid-level administration, etc., nursing. And within this population, very few are within the rural community. As we discussed previously, the advisors usually are from administrative models or in large corporations that, again, do not have that rural voice. The rural advisor program, at least representing the percentage that we have within our community, 20%, would really help us as far as the insight to be able to warn individuals and not maybe warn, but have the insight to appropriate treatment and or outcomes that may be intentional or unintentional with new programs and or interventions that were placed into new models that would be reimbursable. Finally, key recommendations for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is develop specific evaluation and measurement incentives to encourage urban and rural collaboration, including the preference-driven grant scoring. The issue with this is that when we started looking at the collaboration, which is now occurring, many areas, even one state, is now offering two hospitals and 14 rural health clinics and critical access hospitals to join with a continuum without walls to be able to contact individuals, use and interact with their medical health information, et cetera, and share their information freely, but with no patient contract they're going to send each patient, like an ACO. So they're trying to loosen up some of these activities, and so with the collaboration of the rural and the urban facilities starting to occur, our recommendation is with grant writing to scoring to actually look at these small community activities and see if we can prevent the duplication of services and if identify successes and failures rather than let a huge number of the workforce try to innovate themselves. We could actually come up and save billions of dollars by not having reproduction of inappropriate activity. The Secretary also had evaluation of urban-rural demonstrations on a systematic basis so that the small increases in rural costs may be offset by the wide improvement. In other words, the cost of the investigation per patient may be much higher in the initial resource allocation. However, it may actually save costs at the urban level due to the reduced duplication of services and or better transportation or information. Just like Dr. McCollum has talked about at Valdez, when they have observation in their intensive care unit being done by a larger facility, it saved thousands of dollars in the transportation of a patient who may or may not need further intervention and just observation. These same things cannot be tested because if we send a patient off to a facility in an urban area, that person gains the population of a pneumonia or MI, et cetera, as a success, and have that 92-year-old stays in our facility and passes away, that's a death in our facility, scoring a higher loss. So to use the system-wide improvement with the appropriate evaluation tools is very, very important, because I think the integration of these two are already occurring, and it's somewhat skewing some of the reports we've just recently seen. Number six is, finally, the Secretary should direct CMS to review the committee's 2001 recommendations that CMS find quality and cost incentive patients for payments for rural hospitals from actuarially projected savings and increased efficiency. These payments are from data representing outcomes based on rural-based performance. An ACS patient transferred, as we talked about earlier, to a rural center with PTCI, et cetera, in salvage, is represented in a cost savings of one individual, and again, these cost savings are not reflected. Also, the quality and the cost of these incentive payments for rural hospitals, they actually show up as a high cost initially because of the administration utilization of new IT equipment, communication devices, webcams, and et cetera. But actually, we may be saving money in the long run because of the decreased cost by a better care to the patient. So, in summary, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation is probably the bright spot, the dark shadow, as we've not utilized it more effectively. And hopefully, the Secretary will look at some of our recommendations, but also the utilization of our participants today looking at these models and contacting the center, which we actually had the opportunity to speak to their director, and was very open to some of our issues and looking at some of the modifications that may be able to be occurring because of our face-to-face meeting. So I think this is the bright spot in the day, that we have a huge amount of opportunity to step forward and say, now, you may want to cut us, but we can actually save you and show you better forms of integration models by utilizing appropriate transfer services, appropriate intervention of technology and interfacing, and appropriate communication systems that are already being placed that are not available in the urban community where you have large hospitals that are competing against each other. With that, I think we'll stop and ask Mr. Hirsch, or thank you for allowing me to participate with this, to further conclude the question and answer aspect.
Great. Thank you, Roger. Before Steve talks a little bit about some of the future activities of the committee, I'd like to remind folks that we'll have just a few minutes at the end for question and answer. So if you have a question, now would be a great time to go ahead and enter your question in that Q&A box down in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. Steve, I'll let you take it away.
Thank you, Christine. I'll talk a little about what we've been doing this year. In 2013, so far the committee's held one meeting. That was a couple weeks ago in Grand Junction, Colorado. We looked at hospice and palliative care services in rural areas. We met actually at the hospice in Grand Junction. And we're working on a policy brief that should be sent to the secretary and be public by this summer. Later in the year, September, we're going to be in Bozeman, Montana, and we'll be looking at outreach and enrollment efforts around the ACA, and as well as the department's programs and how they intersect with rural poverty on the human services side. So the meetings of the committee are always open to the public, and they're always announced ahead of time on the in the Federal Register and on the committee website, and that the address for the committee website is coming up in a slide or two. So the committee will send these recommendations along to the secretary, and also these are all the policy briefs and annual reports from recent years are posted on the website, and anyone is free to use the information there. It's public access. It's public information. So there's a good deal of background information on the issues that the committee has covered, and a lot of statistics that you might not find elsewhere. So please feel free to take a look at the website, and there is the web address where you can find the committee's publications and more information about the committee, or you can email me or call me here in Rockville. And if there are any questions, Christine, feel free to go ahead now.
All right. It looks like we do have one question. One of our guests is asking one of the members to please say more about the dangers of making any CA reimbursement changes too hastily. Would someone like to address that?
Well, I think that, you know, we've all kind of talked about the big danger is that before the provisions of the Affordable Care Act actually come into play, which is going to take at least another 2 to 4 years before they're a lot of them are really in place. If we make the changes of the CA reimbursement, we may end up losing a significant number of critical access hospitals, and that has enormous implications for as far as the emergency safety net. When a community loses its hospital, it takes a lot to get one back again, and there's several reasons. One is just the loss of the infrastructure. Most of the time, if you have a hospital shut down, you can't really just restart it. There's just a lot of changes that occur as a result of that. And then in addition, the trained staff is something else that's absolutely critical. And that includes the physicians, the nurses, the administrators. It's a whole group who obviously, if there is a closure of a critical access hospital, they're going to go elsewhere. And what I've seen, at least within my experience as being a rural physician, is that once you lose that, you just don't get it back. The example in Cordova was a kind of a unique one with Glen Allen, where they developed a Frontier Extended Stay Clinic after losing their hospital. But it's been a rough road. I mean, this has been something that's been going on since about 1994.
John, I'd like to add to that also. Many of the hospitals are now switching to inpatient-based to outpatient-based. When we start looking at the cost for a hospital, no one's looked at outpatient benefit and services as a benefit. And so there's no information about the benefit to these outpatient services for physicians coming in to specialty clinics from long distances rather than patients traveling back and forth, and the utilization of these services to enhance healthcare and if that's beneficial or not in the global sense. So I think as we look forward with changing our status right away, we may not be called critical access hospitals, but critical access centers where we actually preserve by using information from the community needs assessment, we'll make modifications according to the needs of the community. And so until that's sifted out, I think it's dangerous to try to make recommendations of what's good and bad for us, because we're all kind of sitting in that teeter-totter wondering what to do. The best is to do nothing but become very good planners as far as being good with our communication, our interventions by being able to transfer, and they're using their best healthcare team model that we can come up with locally with our services and care, with especially our higher end cost patients.
Thanks. We have another question. Rebecca asks, do you have any specific plans at this time to help educate folks on the rural healthcare systems in terms of the reform and redesign that was discussed? If you'd like to do a webinar with health networks about the topic, it's Rebecca Davis at NCHN, and she'd be happy to set one up. So what are your specific plans in terms of educating folks on the reform and redesign?
Steve, well, I can say that we make these reports available, and we're trying to push out. So actually, everyone on the call should please feel free to, you know, distribute the information that's available on the website as widely as you can if you think it's useful for people to know. You can also communicate with us here, and committee members sometimes can go out and speak to groups. We don't have a real travel budget that allows us to help with, you know, the costs of traveling. But if they're interested and they are able to, they can go out and do presentations.
Steve, this is Roger Wells. I think the other issue is that we're trying to break down the ACA into parts, and rather than to take on a whole specific aspect. Mm-hmm. Our next meeting's in Bozeman, Montana, where we look at the intervention of the navigator and how it's affecting the healthcare and that successful or unsuccessfully, and to see how that's responding. So I think that to a global issue, we're probably not well represented on specific issues where we developed the white papers and the highest area of needs. I think we can do a fair good job by these webinars. And also by input from other individuals saying, hey, I need help with this, it actually helps us with our agenda and picking the agenda looking forward.
That's true. And we welcome input on issues that the committee should look at as well.
And this is John Cullen. I do think that it is going to be a challenge, though. We're going to have to talk loudly and often about this. And because, as I said, you know, a lot of the healthcare providers are just working as hard as they can just to take care of their patients, and really don't have a lot of extra time to really be investigating a lot of these new options. And, you know, it's kind of like a story about the guy standing by the river and seeing people float by, and he sees somebody floating in the water, and so he dives in, saves them, pulls them out of the water, and looks up, and there's somebody else floating down the river. He dives in and saves him, too. And he's so busy jumping in the river and pulling people out that he doesn't have time to find out who's pushing people up in the river upstream. And so it's... I think we're going to have to, we really do have to work on the education component, because a lot of, especially rural providers, just don't have the extra time in order to be looking at this. And I know it's unfortunate, but I think that's just the way it is. I do a lot of education within the American Academy of Family Physicians, and these are all topics that we've been talking about intensively for the last few years, and yet most of our members, I think, are still very unsure about what it is that these provisions will entail.
All right. One last question. Can you say more about the ability to build population management learned through the APCP demonstration project? Is anyone familiar with that?
The APC, what was it?
Let's see, the APCP demonstration project. Advanced primary care.
Oh, okay.
Now that was, that was mine. Yeah, excuse me, that was the billable services that are according to the guidelines that we reviewed. There were billable services actually available for Medicare recipients who were being managed in the FQHC model programs that were involved in the programs only, not on every FQHC, but just in the model programs.
Thank you. Well, it looks like we're out of time, so that brings us to the close of the webinar. And on behalf of the Rural Assistance Center, I'd really like to thank our speakers today from the National Advisory Committee. This is a great update on your work and some really important issues. I'd also like to thank our participants for joining us. Please note that a survey should open on your screen as you exit the webinar today, and we really encourage you to complete the survey and provide us that feedback that we can use for future webinars. Once again, the slides from the webinar are currently available at www.raconline.org/webinars. In addition, a recording and transcript of today's webinar will be made available on the RAC website and also sent to you by email in the near future. The survey link that will also be included in that email for anyone who's not able to complete the survey today. So thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.